The Gospel of John provides a powerful narrative of Jesus' last actions before Judas betrays him. Jesus washes the feet of his disciples in an act of servant leadership. He teaches them and gives them the new commandment to love one another as he has loved them. Finally, before heading out to the garden, Jesus prays for his disciples. It is a powerful prayer for their ministry and life together. Our reading is found in the 17th chapter of John. It is how his prayer concludes. Jesus prayed, "As you have sent me into the world, so I have sent these disciples into the world. And for their sakes, I sanctify myself, so that they may also be sanctified in truth. I ask not only on behalf of these followers, but also on behalf of those who will believe in me through their word, that they may all be one. As you, Father, are in me, I am in you. May they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. The glory that you have given me, I have given them, so that they may be one as we are one, I in them and you in me. That they may become completely one, so that the world may know that you have sent me and they have and have loved them even as you have loved me." Here ends the reading for today.
Friends, will you pray with me? God of love and life, God of all things and all places and all peoples, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of each and every one of our hearts be acceptable to you, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. They had run out of time. Jesus had spent 3 years with these 12 people that we know as the disciples. He had taught them. He had shaped them. He had molded them over the course of 3 years, sometimes in small, intimate gatherings. Sometimes in the midst of great crowds of people. Sometimes he taught them by his words. And equally often, he taught them by his deeds. But the time had run out. Immediately after this prayer, Jesus and those 12 disciples were going to head out to the garden. And there, Jesus would be betrayed. And from there, the events would be undertaken, that his power would come before the power of the world, and that his glory would be found when he was lifted up. And yes, Jesus meant when he was lifted on the cross, not to heaven, but that's a sermon for another day. So Jesus did the last thing he could do for them. He prayed for them. He prayed a long prayer for them. He prayed that God might give them strength, that God might give them endurance, that God might give them hope, that God might guide their ministry. And then he prayed what Casey just prayed. He prayed that those disciples might somehow find unity, that they might come together. He prayed that for them, because they were not there yet. He prayed that for them because they were still fractured and divided. He prayed that for them because while they were striving for the greatest of things, as the Gospels all tell us, they sometimes settled for the lesser things. There are a couple things about this prayer, I think, that are fundamental to our understanding of it. First, you will notice for whom he prays. Jesus says, I pray for these disciples, but I also pray for all who may come to believe through what these disciples have done. Jesus, friends, is praying for us right here and right now, that we might yet become one. There's another part of this prayer, though. He says, may they become one as we are one. May they become one as the Trinity is one. The Trinity, that logical, theological gymnastics feat that is so complicated and yet utterly simple at the same time. The idea that God and Christ and the Spirit, Creator, Son, and Redeemer, are three distinct, different entities, each with different gifts to bring, and yet are joined together seamlessly in one body. Three in one, one in three. That is the kind of unity that Jesus was praying for us, that we might come together and not become an amalgam, but instead bring all of our beautiful gifts, all of our diversity, all of our differences, that we might somehow come together as one beautiful whole, so that we might recognize the same love that God had for Jesus is the love that God has for all of us. And through that, we might extend that love to the end of the world. That is the prayer Jesus offered for his disciples because time had run out. It has been 2,000 years since Jesus offered that prayer. 2,000 years since he offered a prayer that what the disciples might do might spread to the ends of the earth. And the good news is that in many ways, it has. There are hundreds of millions, if not billions, of Christians across this globe who worship and practice God in a diversity and myriad of ways, who bring their best self before the holiest of selves. Today is World Communion Sunday. In case you didn't circle that on your calendar, in case you don't have brunch plans made in that honor, let me tell you what it's all about. The World Council of Churches, 50 years ago, noticed that this symbol right here, this symbol that is designed to bring all of us together, inadvertently, unexpectedly, and tragically, was breaking the church apart. Our decisions about what happened here, what the power was at work, who was welcome, what we should eat and how we should serve it, were things that were causing division rather than unity. And so the World Council of Churches set aside this Sunday every year that every church across the globe might pause and celebrate communion, and that we might do so in a spirit that reminds us that what binds us together is stronger than anything that divides us about this table. That they may be one. When we began our great experiment as the United Church of Christ in the late 1950s, the decision was made that that prayer would be our motto, that that prayer would appear right here on our seal, that we might be one, that we would be a united and a uniting church, that all of our differences would come together and join this table in a beautiful tapestry of life. And while we can rejoice that over 2,000 years, the beauty of God, the love of God, the truth of God has resonated through millions of people's hearts, I think it would be fair to say that this great ecumenical experiment is in deep turmoil and deep jeopardy. Too often, we find ourselves divided on matters of theology and practice. We find ourselves divided on human things rather than listening to this prayer of Jesus that we might all be made one. Too often, people on the outside don't see what we see on the inside, that we are together as one family, that this is, no matter how you look at it, this is one table. whether it's perfectly aesthetically pleasing, whether it's perfectly functional or not, it's somehow this table, it hangs together. And yet, there are scores of people, hundreds of millions of people, billions of people who don't see the church this way, who are in fact dissuaded from even coming into the church because of how we treat this table and because how we treat our brothers and sisters. There was the young woman in Madison, Wisconsin. She had grown up in a church, and she had stopped darkening the doors of the church years before. She had done so because people had told her over and over again that her sins were unforgivable, that there was no redemption for someone like her. And at first she kept going, but then she believed them. And she couldn't find the courage to walk through those doors. But then a tattooed, salty-tongued pastor named Nadia Boltz Weber came to Madison, and Nadia came to speak not in a church, but in a theater, and she could get the courage to come into that theater. But what she said in that theater would break your heart. She told her story. She said, "I know that I am unforgivable. I know that there is no worth in me. I cannot come into a church because the church is not a place that would welcome me." And just like that, the table, so tenuously held together, comes breaking apart. Or maybe you could talk to the young man that I spoke to in Seattle, Washington. I met him by chance. I happened to be wearing a rugby from the University of Richmond, from which I graduated, and he was a current student there. We met up at a dance club, and he came to introduce himself. And we started talking for a little while. And he shared with me, he wanted to know how my experience was at the University of Richmond as a gay man. Because it's in Richmond, Virginia, and it's a very conservative, beautiful-looking campus. And I told him that it wasn't easy, but that I found friends to make it through. He shared with me that such was the case for him, too. But then he said something that took my breath away. He said to me, "I can handle school, but what's really killing me is church." And I took a deep breath, because it was at that moment that I was contemplating this career in the ministry. And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Here's what I know. I have to choose," he said. "My family tells me I have to choose. My church tells me I have to choose. I have to choose between this life-giving thing that I know as church and this inherent part of who I am as a gay man. I cannot be both," they say. And he asked me, "What do I choose?" I told him, "Choose both." I told him that I had. I told him that I was going into the ministry. I told him great stories of churches that I was familiar with. And there was a glint of hope in his eyes that quickly faded into resignation over the fact of he knew his life and his story far better than I could, and the table, it came apart again. Or maybe ask all the people out there who want to come to church because they believe in the things we talk about in here. They believe in our principles of caring for the least, our principles of humble servant leadership, and yet what they see when they look at the church is an organization that worships power every bit as much as others do. An organization that's willing to sweep sex scandals under the rug for the sake of keeping the power structure alive. An institution that's willing to have pastors ask for money so that they can fly around in million-dollar jets. People want to be part of this place, and yet they see a church that doesn't live up to what we proclaim. And the table comes further apart. But Jesus prayed, and prayer has the possibility of fixing all things. He said, "Let them be one, as we are one." And so Nadia Boltz Weber, she turned to that young woman, and she said, "I cannot untell you what you've been told, but let me tell you this truth. This truth is that God's mercy is greater than our deepest sins. God's justice is better than our broadest reach of mind. God's love encompasses you in ways you cannot imagine. And so I think in some ways, I hope in some ways, that that young woman didn't just go to hear preachers in theaters. She may have actually tried church again. I wish I had a good story for him. I really do, because I don't think he made it back to church. But here's what I know. John Calvin, our theological forebear, proclaims that we are sinful. And that is not meant as a negative judgment, but as a truth, that when one drop of sin pervades our body, it coats all we do. And so what Calvin says is that we must let go of the things we hold tightly and instead hold them loosely, that we must turn to God's grace for forgiveness, that we must rely on something beyond ourselves. And so we as a church do things like proclaiming that we're open and affirming, even if we don't quite get it right, that sometimes our language is a binary and exclusive. We strive to extend the welcome, even if sometimes our desire to have an aesthetically beautiful front means that people in wheelchairs can't imagine a way up those steps. But here's what I know. Together, we do our best to push this table closer together. And then we go out in the world, and we serve the world through marches and walks, through humble servant leadership that at least shows a different model to the world of how we believe, what we give our hearts to. And so maybe someone out there at Monument High School or somewhere in Great Barrington who watched people from a church participate in marches or building houses noticed that maybe the church isn't that off kilter after all. 2,000 years ago, Jesus prayed that we might be one. He prayed that for disciples who weren't there yet. We're not there yet either. But we come here because we are one people. We gather around one table, and through that truth, we strive to be Christ's love in the world. On this World Communion Sunday, as we prepare to come to this table, let us remember who we are and to whom we belong. Let us remember the things that divide us, and then let us remember Jesus' prayer. Loving God, may we be one, just as God and Jesus and the Spirit are one. Let us rise and sing.